Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and thank you for joining us here on Spin the Rally Pod, where we're going to be focusing on the Arctic Rally Finland. I'm rally fan Lisa O'Sullivan, and with me, as always, our crack team of rally good talkers. Yeah. Former motorsport team boss George Donaldson, Dirtfish contributor and voice of rally Colin Clock, and Dirtfish.com's senior staff writer David Evans, who today can feel pretty smug because we all made a prediction about who would come out on top in the snow. And to be fair to us all, we didn't do too badly. George, you went for Elvin Evans. He came home in fifth. Colin, your choice, Craig Breen, was fourth. I was denied a glorious victory after backing Kalle Rovanperä, who was second, just 17.5 seconds behind the winner, Ott Tänak, as predicted by Mr. David Evans. Beckham, take a bow.
Yes, thank you very
take
much.
Take a bow, David. I'm happy to say I'm on form. I'm always incorrect, as usual. I'm going to stop backing anyone because am I the kiss of death? Poor Elfin. Sorry.
But I think actually on the video, I did change my mind and back Elvin. We got into the event, but before
if you go back to listen to the last episode that we recorded, you said
Tänak.
Ott Tänak, so that's what counts.
Yeah,
right. But least most importantly, what I have to say right now is a massive congratulations to you, because you have achieved something that Colin Clark failed to achieve in a week in Finland, and that's just to get the name of the event right. Well done. What is it, Cole?
Yeah, I struggled with that. I struggled. I wanted to put extra words into it, but I'm always a little bit verbose, aren't I? Arctic Rally off Finland. Arctic Rally off Finland. I very rarely went with just Arctic Rally Finland. It had lots of
keep
different
it simple
names in my books. But Lisa, fair play to David. Fair play. You know, that was a fair call from him. But if you want to call me,
it wasn't rocket
call
science,
from now
Cole.
On, if you want to call me Mystic Call, just have a little look at one of our videos from the Arctic Rally Finland.
Yeah.
Now, hang on a sec. You two can't do this because in episode 42, where we were looking ahead to the Arctic Rally Finland, George said, can I name the three drivers I think might win? And we all said no. So you can't just keep chopping and changing on different formats.
No, this is nothing to do with drivers winning. This is to do with picking out treacherous corners that potentially might catch one of our drivers out. About 2 hours later, Sebastian Ogier comes into the very same corner and ends up in a snowbank.
Yeah, it was 2 hours after Colin had been saying the camber here is terrible. I would really imagine that Ogier is going to struggle in this left-hander.
Well, let's take us through it. Let's take us through the rally. I mean, first of all, what was it like out there? It looked beautiful.
Oh, it was absolutely stunning. It really was. It's what, you know, every year when we go to Sweden, we hope we're going to see in Sweden. It was, you know, beautiful, beautiful roads with a lovely white base, with decent sized snowbanks, trees that were heavy with snow, and the countryside. Just those beautiful, the lovely thing about snow and when you get deep snow is it's just, you know, rolling mounds of snow everywhere. There's a lovely kind of look to the countryside and the hillside and the fields and the lanes, and it was just absolutely beautiful. And yeah, the absolute perfect winter conditions. You know, it got warm, I'd have to say.
It got less
relatively
cold.
Warm. Less cold, but then up to plus 2, plus 3 degrees at one point. But no, it was magnificent. And the rally itself was just wonderfully run and wonderfully organised, as you would expect from the organisers of Rally Finland. And it was a great, great week. You know, great competition, great setting, really good fun.
We did say that road position would make a difference.
And it did. It absolutely did. That was...
I was disappointed it did.
Oh, yeah. I think it did. Would it be fair, Cole, do you think, to say, and George, that it made the difference because it warmed up?
Yeah.
And it softened that top layer, didn't it?
No dust.
It's off in the top layer. And what we didn't see, and what, you're George, when we talked to you about it before the event, you've seen the snow dust. We talked to Christian Solberg before the event, and he said, look, it's always a problem in the Arctic Rally. Well, remember, the Arctic Rally is run in January, where 90% of the time the temperatures are below freezing. You know, the snow dust only happens when you get cold, cold temperatures. And we didn't get those cold temperatures. Mm. And as you say, David, you know, it loosened or it softened the surface. Mm. And the snow dust wasn't there. So the guys at the front of the field didn't have that to compensate for the fact they were cleaning. And it definitely made a difference. But, you know, don't forget, Kalle Rovanperä was, what, fourth on the road. And he did a good job on Friday evening. He was only 20-odd seconds off the lead. So
Thierry Neuville was third on the road, and he finished third.
Absolutely, yeah. So it certainly made a difference. Breen and Tanak starting at the back definitely made the most of it. But, you know, that George, you know, that's the way it is. You know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. You know, on gravel, if it rains, well, you want to be the first car on the road. Most of the time, you don't.
Mm. Yeah, but equally, you know, I think Tanak just looked incredibly confident throughout. You know, almost you'd say that wherever Tanak had started, you know, he did not look like a man who was going to lose that rally.
Well, do you think if he'd started on the road before Rovanperä, he'd have beaten Rovanperä?
Yeah. You were the one, Colt, that was saying he's back to his best. He's back to his killer instinct and he's back to rah, all that stuff that he had in Toyota. And, you know, he did, though, didn't he? You know, he looked entirely kind of at ease with everything, with the speed. He had that one moment in, I think it was stage five, where he pinged it off the snowbank. But he looked like a man who'd got a little bit in reserve.
Yeah, he controlled it. I'd say after Friday night even, you know, we asked him on Saturday lunchtime, you know, are you now in control mode rather than lead building mode? And he said, you're always just going as fast as you can. But I'm not so sure. I think Friday night he did a great job and he was able then to moderate the risk. And that's really the advantage and that's the luxury of having even a 20-second lead, is that you can pick and choose where you're pushing. And he pushed hard most of the time, but the times where maybe there was that extra jeopardy, that extra risk, well, he didn't have to push to the absolute max because he had that lead. And you look at the times on the stages and the stage wins, and his stage wins came in the first half of the rally. The second half of the rally, as you expect, a little bit more cautious and just maintaining that lead. And he was magnificent. And he's a real threat this year. He's a real threat. With the rallies now behind him, you know, the initial bedding in period with Hyundai more or less behind him and the car improving on every event, he's a real threat this year.
Like he said himself, Colin, you know, no excuses this year. He spent last year getting to know the team. He knows the team now. And from him and from the team, he doesn't want any excuses. You know, he's got the chance. He's got the car. So it's up to him and to Hyundai to go and win the championship. But I think we saw a real statement from Thierry Neuville in Finland. You know, potentially Neuville is looking stronger than ever. As we said, you know, he came in. His season was compromised just on the eve of Monte Carlo, when obviously Nicolas Gilsoul walked out, or they parted company, whatever, and Martin Vidergi arrived, new co-driver. And after just two rounds, you know, he's only 4 points behind Kalle Rovanperä in the championship. I think that is the best possible start that Thierry could ever have hoped for after what happened just before Monte.
Can I ask you mentally, what the language issues were between him and Martin in the car? Did they just have a misunderstanding?
No, Martin speaks Flemish, apparently. And when he speaks French, the accent is not exactly the same. It's not instantly recognisable in the way that it was with Gilsoul. So Thierry said he's really struggling with just selected words that are not coming out. You know, there's nothing wrong with the
is
word
this like
itself.
A British thing where you've got a really Scouser talking to a really Cockney?
No, Flemish and French are quite different languages, surely.
No, but it's not the word, George. It's not the word. He's getting the word out in French, but it's coming out and it doesn't sound like because his accent.
Yeah, his accent.
Yeah, and it's different.
So it's not a different word at all. You know, it's nothing to do with the Flemish and French thing. It's the fact that he's not speaking French in a way that's recognisable to Thierry for these odd words.
But it's not just that. That simplifies it, David. That in some ways oversimplifies it, because as I understand it, you know, if they were having a conversation face to face, there'd be no issues. You'd understand every word. The problem comes at particular moments in the car where the noises, the engine noises, the high revs, at particular points he's uncertain as to the word, the particular word that's coming out. So it's when there are other factors, there are other, you know, audio factors that are interfering, if you like, with the the way he processes the sounds. That is where the problem comes. So it's a real issue. It's a real issue. They've looked at the
big problem,
the intercom system to see whether maybe it's something to do with the intercom system picking up the highs and the lows on the audio differently. I think they've kind of established there's not much more they can do with the intercom system. So what did he say to you, David? He said they're talking about what we would call maybe elocution lessons or something
exactly.
like that.
And that's the point. You know, he wants him to pronounce some of these words with more of a French twang, if you like.
Two solutions for this. Speaking as a team manager.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, first of all, as a team manager, I'm going to say, go and sort out your contractual issues with Nicholas Gilsall. The man was an absolute gentleman, and he obviously felt very hard done to. So go and sort that one out. But I suspect that's all very damaged now, so that'll never happen. And the other one is, God rest his soul, old Jim Bamber would have made a really funny cartoon out of this. It would have been amazing. And if anyone doesn't know who Jim Bamber is, go and just look it up. You'll find some Jim Bamber cartoons absolutely hilarious on the day.
And almost certainly, LOLO would have been in that.
Yes. Oh, yes. It would just be stunning. Another British reference. We have to go. Jim was good internationally.
He was.
George, I think the point you make, though, about Gilsall is interesting. You know, I think there may have been more efforts to perhaps come to some sort of agreement and to smooth over the issues that they have if Monte Carlo had gone really badly. And then clearly, had Arctic Rally gone badly, he would have been looking for another solution, not just an intercom or, you know, an audio solution. He'd have been looking for another co-driver. But as David says, it's the best start he's had in a very long time.
Yeah.
And you know, you know, George, as well as anyone, that sometimes your drivers who, like I suppose Neuville, who is, you know, he's forever the bridesmaid, isn't he? What's he had, 4 or 5 second places in the championship? You keep doing the same thing and you're going to get the same results. Sometimes things have to change.
Many drivers have done that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a forced change, and it may well be that it's clearly not working. Can you do that as a double negative, David?
Yes, you can. You can. I'm going to let you do the double negative. I understand.
Thank you. It's working. It's not working perfectly. But, you know, it's the knock-on effects sometimes of these things are difficult to actually spot immediately. Yeah. You know, there are maybe other things that are improving because of the relationship. So, you know, I think he'll stick with him. I'm absolutely certain he'll stick with him.
Well, he will, Cole, because we asked him, you know, straight out, you know, does Martin stay in the car for Croatia? Yes. You know, almost before I'd got the question out, yes. And they're doing this this event in Italy in the R5 car for one reason, to build confidence. And personally, I think, you know, the psychological aspect of Thierry being where he is, having come through that really difficult start, will really help him moving forward. And, you know, as we said, Croatia, we don't know too much about it. You know, it's a little bit like a Corsican type of surface on the tarmac there. If we get some inclement weather, some compromised conditions, you know, Thierry could be one of the main players there now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Totally. Well, there's long history of both drivers keeping their co-drivers and changing them and with varying degrees of success in both fields. You know, you might say that Jari Mäntylä-Latvala always stuck with Mika, who's a fantastic co-driver, and there was lots of people said on many, many occasions that Jari should change his co-driver, you know, to get a benefit of change. But Jari chose not to, and it would have been a really hard decision to have made the change, because Mika was the commensurate professional, and I think did an incredible job in the car. But you know, you've got many drivers. For instance, Ott Tanak, he changed his co-driver very regularly for a time, and never seemed to brake step, except if there was an issue, he would get rid of that co-driver and get the next one, and until there wasn't an issue.
I was thinking of Danny Sordo. I was thinking of Danny Sordo, who is very similar to Thierry Neuville in having played second fiddle throughout the championship at times. Yeah. And, you know, chopped and changed and, you know, has gone back to a co-driver as well. Mm.
Yeah. Two or three times he's gone back to the same co-driver. This one he's got this year, whose name eludes me for a second. This is a completely new co-driver to him. But George, the Oit Tanak example you give is a really good one, because you know, when Oit Tanak changed his co-driver for Martin Järvioja, a lot of people said, "This is madness." You know, this kid is really, he's got massively limited experience in the WRC. He has never been in a top level car. Tanak needs someone strong and firm next to him. You know, and there was a lot of talk at the time he should perhaps go with an English-speaking co-driver, because there were plenty of those around. But no, he picked Martin, and from the first stage of the first rally together, you know, it was like a different Tanak. And there were never, ever, ever, as far as I can remember, any issues in that pairing. Yeah. It just just worked really well, and Tanak went on to great success because of it.
Sorry, David, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think, you know, the world championship winning co-drivers, George, and you'll know this, they're of a type. You know, they are not short on self-confidence, and they know exactly what they've got to do, when they've got to do it. And Martin, Järvioja, that is, you know, whether or not he's got a lot of experience at a WRC level, he had those attributes that are necessary to succeed in the championship. But on top of that, you know, when you're coming to these current generation World Rally cars, you've got to have a head for speed, and you've got to have the ability to get notes out incredibly quickly. And that, you know, if Croatia is like Corsica, then, you know, for the third event on the bounce, it's going to be a huge test for Martin Vidigi, because it will be hard to keep firing those notes out. You know, on tarmac, goodness me, they come so quickly, don't they?
Yeah. They really do, and there's so much detail in them, you know. And I mean, I'm not sure what Croatia is going to be like, but I can imagine it'll be a lot of black tar roads and changes of surfaces. All will have to be incorporated into the notes with extra caution, depending whether it's wet or dry.
Cuttings. Gravel notes in there as
Well. Gravel notes on top.
Before we move on to Croatia, though, let's kind of move back towards Arctic.
Let's get cold again.
Let's get chilly before we get toasty warm. The other performances that we all did pick drivers that finished in the top five. So, you know, we could sit back and feel quite smug. But did the Arctic Rally Finland play out the way it should have done? And did it kind of run true to form?
No.
I mean, obviously not for Ogier, but...
100% not, Lise. You know, it didn't, because, you know, before the event, pretty much everybody was talking about Toyota with good reason. Toyota hadn't been beaten in Finland since 2016, when they weren't even there. You know, they had such a strong record. Cars built there, cars designed there, everything is done there. It was a fair assumption that they would be right at the sharp end, and an equally fair assumption that Calle Rovanperä would be leading the charge. And for whatever reason, Jari Matti has promised to come back to us with that reason once they've done their investigation. They think it's something to do with the test road. I'm not sure about that, because, you know, everybody, possibly with the exception of M Sport, who tested just the weekend before the event. So Hyundai and Toyota both tested, as you well know, Cole, in the super cold conditions of sort of -25.
But here's what surprised me on the test, David. I don't think so much it was perhaps the temperatures that were so different. I think they did quite a lot of testing around Jyväskylä, and the road surface around Jyväskylä was very, very different to the road surface on the test. And what surprised me was that we had Ogier testing, we had obviously Katsuta-san testing. I was at both of those tests. Both of them went off when I was there, and I spoke to both of them. And what Ogier said really, really surprised me. He went off on the third run, and he started talking about the tyres and how he was caught out and that they weren't gripping and how they needed to be narrower and all those sorts of things. I thought, but hang on, last week you had a day's test in Jyväskylä, you know. And I think he'd had a previous test as well around Rovaniemi. It just surprised me. I thought, why are they being caught out by the tyres and the lack of grip and whatever, the snow clearing effect, all that, when they've had so much running around Jyväskylä? So I don't know. I don't know whether they had the right test road or not. But here's what I know about the test roads.
it wasn't so much the surface of the road, though, Cole, was it? It was, Yerry Matthew did say, it was the nature of the corners. Did he say there, there were not enough short corners or something like that? I can't remember exactly, but there was an issue with the nature of the road. I think, you know, the grip in the road was different. Oh, sorry, it was the same because ice is ice is ice. You know, it wasn't I wouldn't have thought the roads would be watered in Evascula, and they weren't watered for their test in Rovaniemi either. But, you know, George, I mean, how much of a difference does it make if you're testing and you're running on a surface in minus 30 and then you're competing on a surface in 2 or 3 degrees?
Well, fortunately, it should be probably the same for everyone at that point, generally speaking. But if it's not, I think you could be in trouble. We talked about that pre-event. There is always a risk that someone sets their car up. And, you know, when Ogier says, you know, these tyres, he didn't feel he was getting the grip from them, he didn't understand it. We are talking about the last couple of percent only. You know, everything would have been 99.9% perfect, but that doesn't matter because it ain't 100%. And that's enough to just knock these guys off. And it does. And it's not unfair or wrong. It's no comment on the driver's ability or anything like that. Far from it. It's just how it is.
And we hadn't seen Calais looking lost. Oof. And it's fair to say Friday evening, Saturday lunchtime, he looked lost. Perhaps not so much lost, just frustrated. Frustrated.
Dejected,
because he knew he had that opportunity and it didn't play out. And just over a year with Toyota Gazoo Racing, he has not had that. You know, he's had the perfect car pretty much all the time. And so, you know, to come away with the result that he came away with demonstrates tremendous maturity and, you know, the drive of a championship leader.
Yeah.
The World Championship's youngest ever championship leader.
But yeah, absolutely. And incredible. Worth more discussion there, of course. But again, you know, you say he was completely lost. He's only lost in that he couldn't understand why he wasn't being able to match Ott Tanak from, you know, what he'd already said was the ideal position on the road, just exactly where he wanted to be. So it's almost not as if they're questioning the car, they're questioning themselves and their own ability more than questioning the car. And I'm not trying to be overly smart here or question or deride the driver in any way. Far from it. You all know me well enough to know I wouldn't do that. But it's just a question of their own confidence. You know, they thought they were going to be in a great position. And
it was completely the other way around, though, George. You know, because Robin Perra said, I know I'm driving well. I know that I'm, you know, everything is right from my side and the time's not there. Mm-hmm. He was totally confident in what he was doing behind the wheel, but the car just wasn't, you know, there was a load of understeer in the car. He couldn't get a balance right. Mm. All of these things we'd never really heard him say before. And it was the same with Elvin. You know, when Elvin got into the ruts on the second pass, he was struggling like hell. Mm. But first pass, we saw, you know, both of his fastest times came on the first pass. Equally, Hyundai historically has been stronger where there's been more grip in the road on that second pass. So it was a really odd one. For sure, Arctic Rally Finland did not play out the way we expected it.
Well, I mean, as you know, Jari Matti's promised to come back to us with the lowdown on it and all strength them for that. But I think it'll be very, very difficult to pin it down properly. As a team, you go away and you, whilst you do a debrief for this event, you're doing that with a view to focusing forward. Did we make any mistakes here? What were they? Let's make damn sure we don't do it again. Do we need to throw in an extra test? I've even seen, I mean, I know I've been party to a couple of times when we were in the past, when I've been in a team that was, you know, have given a woeful physical performance where we should have been doing much better. You've actually gone back and tested again to find the reason, or even gone back and taken rally stages and tested over them again to figure it out. And sometimes they've found, you know, really silly things like, you know, a shock absorber was built wrongly. You know, has the person putting the diffs together, you know, they were talking about understeer, has something been assembled incorrectly that's managed to go right through the whole four cars or all three cars, shall we say. There's a potential for a mistake like that to have happened. You know, it's something that you probably wouldn't normally consider, but It could be. I've seen shock absorbers assembled incorrectly. I've seen diffs assembled incorrectly. Mm. You know, we've had situations where people have gone out and finally they've discovered they've been running on the wrong tire pressure. You know, I mean, that's a 101, even below 101 level on that. But it can be as simple as that.
What you got to say, though, is much as Toyota underperformed, I think it's reasonable to say they underperformed. You know, Hyundai, they got it right. Did they overperform? I don't know. But they certainly performed at the level that we would hope to, that we did hope to see. You know, for me, Adamo put massive pressure on everyone, himself included, before the event, because you're looking at it saying, goodness me, you know, you're demanding a win, you're demanding a return to form on an event that, you know, could be really, really difficult for any of your drivers to win. And at the end of the day, you look at it, he had, what, 4 cars in the top 7, 3 cars in the top 4. It was a complete reversal of fortunes for Hyundai and Toyota. And
to be fair, also, Colin, though, I mean, you know, we say that, you know, Toyota weren't at the races. Cali Rovenpera is only 17 seconds off the lead.
And he's in front of Thierry and he's in front of Craig,
you know, and in fairness, Elfin's less than 10 seconds behind Craig Breen. So it could have been two in the top four.
It wasn't a disaster. It wasn't a disaster.
But I think that in itself is a pointer to just what we expected from Toyota, isn't it? You know, the fact that we look upon a 17-second or whatever defeat for Cali Rovanperä as a fairly significant failing.
Trouncing, you're suggesting it's hang your head in shame, take the walk of shame.
Not quite, Georgie. But
well, good. I'm glad we're getting some perspective on this. Thank goodness.
But equally, you look at Monty and Hyundai's result in Monty wasn't so bad. 2 cars in the top 5.
Yeah, but it was a disaster as far as Adamo was concerned.
But Thierry said, and was very, very careful not to contradict the word of Adamo, but Thierry did say that, you know, he didn't feel it was quite as bad as Andrea made out. And I think there's some justification in that, really, because... You know, his as we've already discussed, his event was compromised, but he was on the podium. You know, Tanak was unfortunate, fastest on Friday night on both the stages in Monte, and then had his puncture issues, and that ruled him out. Sordo was, you know, a little bit disappointing, but I could see where Thierry's coming from there. But equally, you can see Adamo's point that he saw it from the inside, and he saw, you know, his own frustrations that he wasn't able to prepare in the way that he wanted to prepare. So I'm not sure where I've talked us around to.
Quite sure where you have either.
Whizzing back.
It's quite interesting that Adamo, you know, he talks like some form of very aggressive football manager that's been there and done it all himself. Well, he hasn't. He hasn't sat in a car and driven it at those speeds. And that's fairly harsh in many ways, his behaviour towards... the drivers, and fairly demanding. But by God, you know what? When you make massive demands of people, when you drive them hard, and for this you've got to give Adamo 100% marks, he probably riles up those drivers and gets them all quite excited at times.
Probably. Well, and he definitely riles them up.
You know, back-to-back world championships. That's a hell of a thing to do. Themselves, don't they? You know?
Yeah.
It's a different style of management, certainly to the one that we see at Toyota now with Yari Natti. But it works for them.
But is there a point where you're going too far, where you're intimidating drivers and where you're putting almost too much pressure on them, too much expectation on them? Is it possible to do that?
Yes, of course it is. You know, I mean, like, let's say shouting the odds at a driver and, you know, a driver's come in from a dreadful morning, you know, you'll need to do a lot better than this or you're not driving for me again. The driver goes out and has a terrible accident, you know? Mm. That sits on Adamo's shoulders when he's shouted at a driver like that. That's a very, very, very... big thing to, I mean, ultimately, you know, he wasn't in the car and he wasn't driving it, but it's a big thing to carry on your shoulders. I think that, you know, if Toyota's now being run by a committee, somebody's going to have to step up and actually be the hard guy and the bad guy that's going to actually push every now and again, and not necessarily as hard as I was suggesting that somebody could, but it's occasionally someone's got to stand up and be the tough guy in a team, because otherwise, you know, George, whole lot of teams of committees doesn't work. You don't win with
that. That's the first time I've heard that said, and It kind of shocked me when you just said that, George, but it's absolutely right. It is being run by committee. And you know, certainly from things that I've observed in the past, it's not a natural way to success.
I'm not sure about that.
But
it is, George.
I'll counter what I said, Colin. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm assuming it's been run from the committee by the way it's been presented to the press. But look, you've got some great people in there. And we talked about this when we first started. Yari Mate is the guy that's got to be the tough guy sometimes to say, look, no, I'm sorry, we're going to have to, you're all coming back for another test because I'm not satisfied with the results we've got. I'm not liking what I'm hearing. I've got a little niggle in the back of my mind that says, we're not doing enough here. Guys, back to the test. I want you to all double down and do more work. Tom, go away and develop this, refine it. I know you were going home to your family this weekend, but you're not. You're staying here. You're doing extra. I don't think Tom, I don't think Kai Lindstrom, Yari Mati, these guys are all focused on the job. But, you know, you have to be tough sometimes.
And, I don't think I'm
hoping there's someone there that will be that. I think Tom will be the tough guy.
Having just argued against Toyota being run by a committee, I actually don't think it will be Yari Mati that would say that at all, because I think Tom is totally in charge of the technical aspect of the team, and Yari Mati would gently feed into that from what I've seen so far this year. But
how,
you know,
does that work?
It's
how
very straightforward, Colin, for goodness sake. The car is Tom's business. Tom runs the car. If Tom's not happy, as George says, with a certain aspect of the test, Tom says, you go back, you test again. And Yari Mati says,
what if the car's not performing, David?
It's down to Tom.
No, hang on. It's down to Tom, but who is the one that's putting the pressure on Tom other than himself? And that's a cop-out if we just say he puts the pressure on himself.
Haruna.
You know, because,
Haruna-san
because we all
at the
do.
Top. He's the man at the top. So you know, so we are being quite naive here if we think Yari Mati is standing at the top of the table, banging his fist. Yari Mati is a brilliant signing for Toyota in that he is the public face of that team. He's also a driver, the most experienced driver in the history of the World Rally Championship, who can feed in a whole bunch of anecdotal evidence from events where he's done this and, you know, 20 years ago he's done that. But it's a three-way thing, you know. It's Haruna, it's Kai Lindstrom, and it's Tom Fowler. And, you know, Cole, it's not, you know, Yari Mati would have a great deal of input, but personally, I don't see him at the same level taking massively significant decisions, certainly not on the technical side. It's Tom's car. You know, that's where it begins and
ends. I would still like to think that Yari Mati could intervene on all those levels to say, guys, I think we need to do a wee bit more.
But
I'm
not saying he can't, George, but I'm not saying he can't. But what I'm saying is he doesn't, I don't think, right now. Because certainly two rounds into his career, you know, Tom has built the car. The car is 4 years into a five-year cycle. Next year's car, Tom is already well on the way with the 2022 car. I'm not saying that at some point, you know, Yari Mati will have some input, but potentially Juho Hänninen's going to have more input into the car because, you know, he's the one that's testing it more often. This is where it's a really tricky position for Yari Mati because he's not driving the car, he's not testing the car. Therefore, you know, he's using his own experience.
But I'll tell you now, David, it's a difficult... And look, you know, these are all hypothetical situations we're talking about, but we draw on our experience from the past to come up for what we think might happen in the future. But when you have a situation like that in any business, where there is not one person taking ultimate responsibility, it rarely works. When you have a committee, you have a guy... I'm in charge here. This is my department. But you've got no one pushing him. You've got no one with the checks and balances. You know, and I'm in charge of driver strategy. I'm in charge of the engine. I'm in charge of the chassis. I'm in charge of whatever. You have to have someone at the top who ultimately takes responsibility and makes sure that everyone is performing to the best of their abilities. Yeah, we saw it at ProDrive. When ProDrive went, you know, to pieces, and they went to pieces, it was because no one was in charge. No one, you know, everyone was in charge of their own little departments, but no one appeared to be in charge overall. If the situation you're describing, David, is the correct situation, it may be an ignorant view of mine, as you've said, it may be.
So, Cole, did Sven Smeets have exactly the same power and authority that Jos Capito had at Volkswagen?
Oh, come on, David, that's a ridiculous comparison.
No, he took over the same position.
How long did he last?
Yeah, but the results didn't change.
No. That's not a reasonable. That's not the same situation.
I totally disagree. You know, if you've got each department firing on all cylinders, then where's the problem?
Until it what? No. That is naive. That is utterly naive.
How is it, Colin? You know, Tom Fowler's got. He's built the perfect car. Kyle Lindstrom knows the regulations better than anybody. You know that's Toyota's view. That's why he's in that position. Therefore, you've got the bases covered.
Until things start to go wrong, until you don't.
So when have things gone wrong for Toyota?
No, David. But your past success does not guarantee future success. You know,
I tell you what, Colin. Let's revisit this at mid-season, and I suspect.
No. Let's not. Let's revisit it in 2 or 3 years' time. Revisit it in mid-season is not. Well,
I think 6 months will be fine, Colin. I think it'll be okay. I think if there's anything happening there, you'll see it. You'll see it quite quickly, I think, David.
But it would, as I've said, I think, and this is nothing against any of the people involved in the situation there. I know they're all absolutely A1 operators, from Jari Matti to Harunasan to Kyle Lindstrom and Tom Fowler, A1 operators. But my concern would be the same concern for any business, any team, without an absolute leader taking responsibility and overseeing all of the various different components, you lay yourself open to problems, to potential problems that go unchecked, unnoticed, until it's too late. Until it's too late.
Of course,
give you an anecdote, Colin.
Football podcast, we'd be talking about whether or not you sack the manager because the fitness coach is rubbish or whatever, you know.
Well, I can give you an anecdote relating to Toyota some years ago when I was team manager there. The last year that we competed in the World Championship in 99. Our car wasn't great, hadn't been great in 98, hadn't been brilliant in 99. That was the Corolla. It was the drivers weren't happy with it. They weren't getting, you know, brilliant results. We didn't get a lot of wins. But we won the championship in 99. And we had half an idea that was our second last year in the championship. We expected to go to 2000 before we stopped as the team moved into Formula One. But we got stopped a year early. But I ended up being really, really hard and very unpopular in my team. And I was a team manager and it was very much you were pushed away from the technical side as much as possible, except when they needed budget, they would come to me for budget. But I managed to just make myself very unpopular and insist on extra tests for the drivers and insist on extra developments coming. And when developments were asked of me, I said, well, I even asked what we were testing, what we were testing. And when they told me we were testing square wheels again, I basically said, no, you're not getting the budget for it. You can test if you're testing round wheels. Mm. And I mean, that was the level of ridiculousness of some of the requests I felt we were getting now. I maybe had no place to do what I was doing, but I made myself very unpopular with a number of the engineering team. I made myself very popular with other engineers in the engineering team because I just wouldn't brook the nonsense that was going on. And I drove the team really hard and we went to events and you could test through the recce in those days. I was making test cars available for testing. This is a team that everyone always said had the most money. We were the only team that didn't run a helicopter on European events because I wouldn't spend the money on a helicopter. I'd rather spend it going testing to try and make the car go a little bit better than it was. And by hook and by crook, I pushed everyone around me and we won that championship just by the skin of our teeth. But, you know, you can narrow it down to basically China Rally, which we won, where I made an unbelievable effort. I was even getting threats from what I was told was Chinese mafia because I was just being such a hard bugger on everyone around me. And I wasn't filtering any nonsense that was coming my way. I wasn't having it. I just bulldozed my way through it and got quite unpopular with a few hoteliers and things like this. Things typically on the side of the core issues, but I just wasn't having any of it. The team was always, you know, dreading when I was walking up because I was always wanting to push things harder and make people go back out to test. The guys are wanting to have dinner. Fortunately, the food wasn't that good there, so you weren't missing much by way of dinner. I would send a chef out and they could have dinner at the roadside. But, you know, I made myself quite unpopular as much as I could within the context of me being a team manager at that time in that team. And I can tell you, it was all down to the fact that I was prepared to do that. That's why we got that championship ultimately. I was the last little straw that broke the camel's back that won the championship. And if I hadn't done it, we wouldn't have got it. And I think everyone involved in it at the time kind of recognised it. Like I said, I wasn't overly popular with that many people. There was three or four people that understood what I was doing and appreciated it, but not many. Not even my boss, Uwe Andersson, really understood, although he backed me for it.
Could we move just a little bit on, George? Were you at Toyota, in 1993?
Yes, I was. Yeah.
So I would like us to move on to the next big topic of last week. Hannu Mikkola's final rally was Thousand Lakes as a factory driver. The 93 Thousand Lakes. Do you remember that event?
Yes, I do very, very well. It was such a privilege to get to meet with them and work with them. So I was coordinator. I was working as a coordinator on that event.
Yeah.
So I was normally the workshop manager in Africa at that point. So Kenya, I would spend 6 months a year in Kenya. But Finland was one of the rallies I got to be the coordinator on. So I went out and did all the recce. And then they were testing what we called the fresh air system, which was, everyone knows, as anti-lag now, which is basically this system where the throttle stays wide open. And when you lift off the throttle, you cut the fuel. So fuel cut. And you cut the spark and you cut the fuel. Actually, it keeps injecting fuel into the engine, sorry. And then there's the occasional spark from the spark plug, usually when the exhaust valve's open, and it would ignite all the fuel in the exhaust system and spin up the turbo.
That's all great, George, but
torque.
I wanted, what did Hannu Mikkola, yes. What was he like?
Hannu Mikkola was the test driver. He was the one, so he hadn't been involved in terribly much testing, but he was asked to do the event, partly as a reward for being Uwe's friend and giving him his very first victory. Was it in 1973, Finland?
It was,
73?
Yeah, was it
74?
Earlier. No, I think it was 70. Was it 70?
No, it wasn't 70. No, no,
no, it was. It was 74. It was the year
74, okay.
Between the Mark 1 and the Mark 2 Escort, wasn't it?
Okay, so 20 years later, or just short of 20 years later, Uwe gave him another drive, which was, you know, they were friends, and they worked together for years, and Hannu gave the most incredible win in a 1600 normally aspirated car against all the BDA Escorts and Lancia Stratuses or whatever the Fiat corporation had out at that time. Amazing.
But a beautifully balanced car, that one, wasn't it?
Apparently, Hannu said, Hannu was the one that predicted the win. Uwe wasn't thinking he could win, but Hannu had apparently gone to him not long before the start. And I do remember talking to Hannu. I think I got a dinner with him and Uwe not long before the start of that event. And Arne Hertz would have probably been along. And we had a really lovely long chat. And of course, I was just ribbing into Hannu. My first proper chance to sit and talk to one of my, you know, teen heroes. You know, when I first started getting involved in rallying, Hannu was the man. Mm. Hannu was the Sebastian. He was the first Sebastian Ogier in my era, at least. He was the man that everything he went in an Escort for a while, he just couldn't lose anything. You know, it felt like. And he was a masterful to watch. Never looked flamboyant.
No, a very conservative driving style. But I think in that, just trying to find desperately on here, I think whatever year it was.
But what?
It was, there it is. Okay, so it was 1975. So it was between the two cars.
75, yeah.
But it was Atso Ahu who co-drove for him.
It was. Now, Atso I worked with for years as well.
He was the Finnish importer, wasn't he, of Toyotas?
No, I don't think Atso was the Finnish importer of Toyota.
He had a contact in the importer because apparently there was no budget from Toyota from Uwe to run the car. He could give him the car, but he couldn't find the cash to run it. So Mikkola had gone to the Finnish importer of Toyota and said, "What can we do?"
And Atso was the contact.
He came up with some solutions, but it was an absolute sort of shoestring job with very few mechanics. From reading historically, it was a car that, like you say, you know, after a bit of testing before the event, he suddenly realized that it's not the quickest thing, but it's the most stable. It could be driven
driving
in a straight line.
It just, it was the most fantastic chassis, a lovely, lovely, lovely car. And he drove it just unbelievably well. Atsu Aho, his co-driver at that time, was also a driver. I think he'd been lying as... Did he finish, I think, maybe second or third on a Finland rally in the minis back in the mid to late 60s? And so he was a driver and a co-driver. And he was one of our key gravel note crews and latterly weather crews. I used him for many, many rallies as a weather crew, a fantastic individual.
Hannu was an absolute gent, though, wasn't he? He really was.
He absolutely was. I still can recall that meal, unfortunately, not as clearly as I might want to, but I remember being a bit of a fanboy and apologising for myself, but I was quite clearly just beside myself with joy to be sitting at the table with him at that time. So I think it might have been later before when I had that dinner. You know that? I bet it was. I bet it wasn't actually in 1993. I'll bet you it was 2 or 3 years later when he was just along as a guest. That we had dinner.
And I was going to say, he did continue to compete as a guest driver after his 123 WRC starts, 18 wins, and was driving right up until 2017. It was a lovely tweet from Vesa Mikula on Twitter. It said, "We lost my father, Hannu, to cancer this weekend. Most knew him as a rallying great who ushered in the golden years of the sport. To me, he was dad and an incredible one at that. Always supportive, loving and genuine. Also a loving grandfather to my two boys. Rest in peace, Dad." And then there's a lovely picture of him in the car with his dad. And I did like the fact that at the podium, the Finnish Air Force's F-18s flew over in a memorial flyover, which was just, it was really tingling.
It was, and you know, beyond kind of Finland, he remains the most successful driver in the history of Thousand Lakes or Rally Finland with 7 wins, equally joint with, obviously, with Marcus Grönholm. But also, you know, a massive, massive winner in Britain. He, again, doing a bit of research for a piece which has gone up today, I think it was 8 years in succession, he finished either first or second on the RAC. And, you know, won the 81 event in the Audi, first time the four-wheel drive car had won the RAC. He rolled in Grisdale and still won by 11 minutes.
It's just bizarre.
I mean, he was some sort of driver. He really was.
Yeah.
He was tremendous. And as you said, David, an absolute gent. He took me out in his helicopter on a Thousand Lakes rally 1 year. We went out for, I think, a full day. Maybe it was even a day and a half. And an incredible helicopter pilot. Such a nice touch. You know, nice and safe and careful. But that control, that level of control, that fineness of touch, you can feel it in the helicopter. Mm. It's really nice.
So, and a great story from his first win in 68. As Michelle said, Cole, you know, not a great one for the party. And after he, I guess it would have been the Rantasippi Hotel or something like that in 68, he must have been one of his first ever drives with the Ford team. And he won the event, his first ever victory on the Thousand Lakes. And he was paid apparently £300 for his appearance on the event. Went into the bar briefly to have a beer with the mechanics after the event. After his beer, he was ready for bed, obviously exhausted from his exertions on the rally, and went to go up the stairs. And just as he was going out of the door, the mechanic said, sorry, Hannu, which hotel room are you in? And Hannu turned around and said, obviously, 612 or 314 or whatever his hotel room was. Okay. And then came down to pay his bill the next morning, and the bar bill almost cleaned out the £300 that he'd earned for his appearance on the event. But yeah, it just, you know, the thing that really came over loud and clear in Finland last week is the absolute respect that everybody had for the guy, and just, you know, lovely stories. And if you do get a chance, do go and have a look at the tribute video that Dirtfish has put together to him, because just lovely
catch
words.
Catch that, David, yeah.
Lovely words.
Hannu Mikkola.
Stunning man, yeah. Stunning man.
Well, that's it, I think, from this edition of Spin the Rally Pod. We will be back with more. We've got to look ahead to Croatia next, but I'm sure there'll be plenty of other topics under the radar that will pop above the radar. And if you've got anything you want to ask us, best way to get in touch on Twitter, hashtag Dirtfish Rally. But thank you, George, Colin and David, once again for your company.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, guys. Speak soon.
Yeah, lovely. Cheers, boys.
Oh, and by the way, my battery's still got 5%.
Wow, that's really good.